Welcome, everybody. Can you hear me? Yes, thank you. I think it's time to start. And I'm hoping more people will join us to make it a truly public event during which we will be discussing the public service value of the internet. So welcome, and let me explain the reason for this meeting and for the Council of Europe intent behind it. We had a session this morning on the Internet Bill of Rights. The reason why we're here is that we believe there are already a number of Internet Bills of Rights. There is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. There is the International Covenant. There is the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. There is the European Convention on Human Rights. There is the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. These are all documents which define human rights. And we believe that before you begin to talk about an Internet Bill of Rights, and the people behind that idea are talking about developing existing human rights to fit the internet age, before you begin to talk about an Internet Bill of Rights, the proper thing to do would be to try to understand how existing human rights documents apply to the internet and how the internet can be used to promote and protect those rights. You could say that the whole WSIS process has been a battle for the soul of the internet. On the one hand, there are people who believe the internet is about technology, the internet is about business, the internet is about economic growth. And of course, these are all very valid considerations. However, there are also those who believe the internet is also about something else. The Council of Europe is squarely in the second camp. We do not deny the importance of either technology or business or economic growth, but we do believe that the internet is also about something else, and it is about primarily, we believe, human rights. Now, probably, as we were saying a moment ago, probably the reason why not so many people are here is that they associated the public service value of the internet with public service broadcasting. Well, nothing could be actually further from the truth, in the sense that nobody's proposing the creation of a British internet company. Nobody's proposing that every country establishes a public corporation to take over and run the internet. That is not, certainly not on our minds. But we believe, and this is the definition of the public service value of the internet, which is contained in a recommendation that was very recently adopted by the Council of Europe Committee of Ministers on measures to promote the public service value of the internet. We believe that the public service value of the internet lies in the fact that both the internet and the ICT services serve to promote the exercise and enjoyment of human rights and fundamental freedoms for all those who use them, and that their protection should be a priority with regard to the governance of the internet. So, the role of the internet and the digital technologies in the exercise and enjoyment of human rights, freedom of expression, right to education, right to assembly, right to property, all these other rights, right to free elections, all of these rights are magnified by the internet. All of these rights are enhanced by the internet. And so that's one aspect of the public service value. If the internet operates properly, and that's the issue, how do we make it operate properly, then individuals can enjoy their rights more fully. another aspect of the public service value of the internet springs from the fact that people are today living both in physical space and in cyberspace. I come from Poland, so cyberspace in my mind is identified with Siberia. That may not be the most appropriate association, but somehow this comes to mind. And therefore, what people expect from cyberspace is what they expect from physical space. They expect to be able to meet all of their needs. They expect to be able on the internet to receive all the information they need. The internet is an essential tool for communication, information, knowledge, commercial transactions, entertainment, interaction with other people. So this, we believe, produces a legitimate expectation that internet services should be accessible and affordable, secure, reliable, and ongoing. And we believe that states, governments, should have the obligation to make sure that this is so. I would like to explain how we will proceed with this workshop. I have invited a number of panelists who will tell you what is in the recommendation, in the various parts of the recommendation. We have structured the recommendation in the Council of Europe in such a way as to show that the main themes of the Internet Governance Forum, access, openness, diversity, security, and critical internet resources, all have very clear human rights dimensions, and that existing documents in Europe, the European Convention on Human Rights, elsewhere, other documents, existing documents apply directly to these four themes of the IGF, and if internet policies on the part of governments, but also on the part of many other stakeholders. For example, we have Bob Boorstin here from Google. Google provides, perhaps without knowing that, a public service by providing access to information. Access to information is a legitimate human right. Thanks to Google, that access to information is made easier. So therefore, we are very pleased to have Bob Boorstin with us. We also have with us Morgan Schmidt, a high-ranking official from UNESCO. On my right is Andrew Kelly, a human rights lawyer from Ireland. Next to him is Matthias Treimer from Austria, chairman of the steering committee on the media and new communication services. In case you believe that the steering committee of the Council of Europe tries to steer the media and the new communication services, nothing could be further from the truth. What the steering committee tries to do, it tries to steer the Council of Europe, not the media. Next to him is Yves Poulet from Belgium, and next to him is Lee Hibbert from the Council of Europe. I will ask particular panelists to tell you what's in the particular parts of the recommendation, how we perceive human rights applying to the main themes of the IGF. And after that, the floor will be open for you to exercise your right to freedom of expression and tell us what you think about this recommendation and about this idea that there already exists something like an Internet Bill of Rights in human rights documents. And may I begin with Matthias Treimer, who will deal with the first part of the recommendation on democracy, on human rights and democracy.
Yes, thank you very much, Carol. Just to say it once again, it's a brand new document. It's dated 7th November 2007, adopted by the Committee of Ministers, and it's really worth looking at, and what we really hope that it becomes a major policy document in itself to promote this public service value of the internet by addressing all the different stakeholders to take the necessary policy measures. As Carol has said in his introduction, all is about human rights, as we think. Finally, all these questions we're discussing here also during the IGF have a link, a direct link to human rights, and therefore the first part of the appendix to the recommendation deals with human rights and democracy. What it wants is really to make aware of the fact how can ICTs and the benefit of ICTs be used to enhance the protection of human rights. The new technologies can be a major boost for human rights insofar as they really ease, as we all know, the exercise of rights such as freedom of expression, but also freedom of assembly. We just come out of a workshop where we were discussing about the quality of the internet, which was linked to this topic, exercise of freedom of expression. Well, it's much easier now to exercise his or her freedom of expression by a person all over the world, and some people start a debate complaining that this is then the negative consequences that the internet has no quality at all. It was, of course, a very intensive debate, but we of the Council of Europe see the big value, of course, of the internet, that the exercise of rights such as freedom of expression has immensely improved, and this is what we say here also in this recommendation. We say very clear that any restrictions member states impose on the internet should be in accordance with the rules established in the European Convention on Human Rights. That means we need always a legitimate aid, we need the proportionality, and we need the accountability of states. On the other hand, the recommendation in this human rights part does not overlook that, of course, the internet can be misused to endanger human rights, such as when the right to privacy, the presumption of innocence, and so on. And here the recommendation takes a very clear stance that member states must do everything within their powers to safeguard these rights. Apart from the human rights part, we have also one part about democracy. We are convinced, the Committee of Ministers is convinced, that you should be made for the internet and ICTs to strengthen democracy. Strategies for e-democracy, e-government, e-participation should be developed, and you should be made of new technologies to strengthen the participation and initiative of citizens in public life and decision-making, as well as improving public administration. We think that people, as soon as they feel they can influence a decision if they want to, they can ensure appropriate reactions if a fundamental right is called into question. So, Carol, this is what the first part is about. I think a very important part as introduction, and then we come to the further questions like access and so on.
Yes, thank you very much. Can I now ask Lee Hibbert to deal with access?
Thank you, Carol. I'm just looking at the press release that was released with this recommendation last week, and it doesn't hear? Okay. Sorry. I'm just looking at the press release, which was released with the recommendation last week, and it calls... it states, the internet, a public service for all. Council of Europe calls for affordable access to the internet, unrestricted access to the internet, safe access to the internet, and diverse access to the internet. Of course, access is key in this recommendation, like we all know. It calls, this text, the 47 states of the Council of Europe calls upon them, in fact, to enable a greater number of people to have access to the internet. What does that mean? Access to the internet means access to
to exercise and enjoy rights, freedoms, freedom of expression, as you know, and many others, as part of everyone's right to be active, to be democratic, as active citizens, particularly in Europe. And it was agreed that the states agreed that they were convinced that access to the internet should be regarded as indispensable for full exercise and enjoyment of rights and freedoms on the internet. And in particular, they agreed to uphold rights through access. So access is very important in that context. And it goes on basically, the main elements with regard to access, it talks about developing strategies, a multi-stakeholder strategy between states, between the private sector and civil society to promote access, in particular by promoting access to access, as we've heard in other events, access to the ICT infrastructure, technical operability and open standards and cultural diversity, promoting a diversity of software models, including proprietary, free, and open source software, promoting affordable access to the internet for individuals irrespective of their age, gender, ethnic, or social origin, including the following persons and groups: those who have low incomes, those who are in rural and geographically remote areas, those with special needs, those, for example, like disabled persons who may find access difficult. Access to access is what is the first part of the section on access, technical access in many respects. And then it goes on, I'll just summarize by briefly saying that access with regard to public authorities, having access to the internet through access points, internet points in public places, through public administrations, educational institutions, etc. And then it goes on to talk about access, yes, but effective access to the internet. So how can you really fully exercise access? Well, there can only be effective access if there is if we can promote the integration of ICTs into education and promoting media and information literacy and training in formal and non-formal education sectors for children and adults, in particular in order to empower them to use media technologies to discern, to determine what quality, for example, we were discussing earlier, the quality of content, to create access, store, retrieve, and share content in particular. Again, in accordance with their democratic rights and civic responsibilities to access and use content effectively. And the last point I would just like to say is that access is very much linked to making informed choices when using the internet. And referring to diverse media forms and content from different cultural and institutional sources, understanding how and why media content is produced, critically analyzing the techniques, language, and conventions used by the media and the messages they convey, and identifying media content and services that may be unsolicited, offensive, or harmful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We now pass on to openness, and we have Andrew Kelly to address this issue.
Thank you, Carol. It's a particular pleasure to be able to address this theme in the recommendation, because it's something I'm going to have the chance to pick up on tomorrow in the main session where the Council of Europe is represented, precisely on this issue of openness. And I think together with my colleagues on the panel, I've been listening very carefully to a number of the debates this week, and I'm pleased to see that the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe has been quite prescient in what it's included in this recommendation. Just to try and sum up for you what's in there of note, I hope that you have the text. This whole section on openness is premised on the need to continue to uphold the right to freedom of expression and free circulation of information in a manner that is entirely consistent with Article 10, Paragraph 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights. And that, of course, is the section or article of the European Convention on Human Rights which speaks to the only circumstances in which it's permissible to interfere with the right to freedom of expression. My colleague Matthias has already alluded to some of those, but in essence, the reasoning process that states and others are being called upon to go through is to look very carefully at whether an interference with freedom of expression is prescribed by law. Is there a lawful basis for it? Is it necessary in a democratic society? And if it is the nature of the interference proportionate? And I think if you apply that test in practice, you sometimes get results that you might not have expected to begin with. And I just wanted to recall in this context, as it is such a cardinal principle, that the leading case still in this area is now over 30 years old. It's the case of Handyside, where the European Court of Human Rights was crystal clear about the fact that freedom of expression constitutes one of the essential foundations of democratic society and one of the basic conditions for its progress and for the development of everyone. And it went on to say that it's applicable not only to information and ideas that are favorably received and regarded as inoffensive or a matter of indifference, but also to those that offend, shock, or disturb the state or any sector of the population. Such are the demands, the court said, of that pluralism, tolerance, and broad-mindedness without which there is no democratic society. So the standard that the Committee of Ministers is reaffirming in this new recommendation as regards openness is exactly that. Not that it would be a nice idea to properly respect freedom of expression in the internet age, but that if it is not properly respected, that in fact undermines democratic society in itself. Then the recommendation under openness goes on to unpack what the Committee of Ministers considers are the component elements that can help to protect that principle in the information age. It calls for active participation of the public in using and generating content on the internet. So by contrast, for example, with the kind of line that is advanced by authors like Andrew Keane, who see mass participation in the internet as a threat to the privileged position of established elites. The Council of Europe is saying very clearly and at the highest political level in the organization that it greatly welcomes the democratization of information on the internet. Secondly, the recommendation calls for the promotion of freedom of communication and creation on the internet regardless of frontiers, and it identifies a number of respects in which that might be under threat in a practical way, and calls upon states to refrain from filtering or other restrictions, which shouldn't go beyond those applied to other means of content delivery, to facilitate reusers in a way that's respectful of copyright and other intellectual property rights, and to promote an open offer of services and accessible, usable, and exploitable content tailored to different users and social groups. And I just wanted briefly, Carol, to footnote there the fact that I really do welcome the fact that Bob is on the panel and that yet again Google have been prepared to put their heads above the parapet at the Internet Governance Forum. Of course, we know what happens sometimes to people that put their heads above the parapet. But I think in fairness, we have to recognize that they are amongst a very small number of major companies of that sort who are prepared to do it. However, I would encourage Bob maybe to share with us views that he might have on how this aspect of this particular recommendation might be of relevance not only to states but also to companies like Google, because as Matthias has said, they are involved in the delivery of a public service. The Council of Europe is perfectly clear that companies like Google are involved in the delivery of public services. And I have to say the subtext of what I've heard from you, Bob, in certain other sessions and also from some of your colleagues, it almost seems to be just trust Google and everything will be okay. You know, we're thinking about these things, and we'll get back to you. The subtext that I'm hearing from other participants is that, you know, perhaps we don't always trust Google on issues like filtering and promoting open offers of services and so on. So I'd be interested to hear if you think, looking at this Council of Europe recommendation, that there are ways in which, in the way that you go about your business, those standards could be taken into account in a way that is empowering of people. And just rapidly to conclude, there are two other major elements under the heading of openness, promoting public domain information accessibility in the internet. There the Committee of Ministers is thinking of things like making available government documents that allow all people to participate in the process of government, and also information about personal data that's retained by public entities. And lastly, and I think this is an interesting one, and one that needs to be looked into in its own right almost as a topic, adapting and extending the remit of public service media in line with another Council of Europe recommendation, recommendation R2007-3, also of this year. I would encourage you to look at that because it's really part of a whole battery of material, standard setting material that the Council of Europe has been producing in very recent times. It's very up-to-date material, and it's an attempt really to crystallize the manner in which human rights standards can remain relevant and meaningful in the information society. And what that recommendation does, if you have a look at it, 2007-3, is it reaffirms, amongst other things, the need to safeguard the fundamental public interest in the information society. There you have that language again, an echo of the public service value, or something that presaged that what you were going to do with that later recommendation, including not only freedom of expression and access to information, as I've been speaking about, but also media pluralism, cultural diversity, the protection of minors, and human dignity, in conformity with Council of Europe standards and norms. And what it does, it's quite a detailed and technical recommendation, is it sets out the legal, technical, financial, and organizational conditions that the Council of Europe thinks need to be in place if public service media are to play their part, as they ought to do, in promoting and protecting the public service value of the internet. So I think that's a brief summary of what's in the openness bit.
Thank you very much. I'm sure, Bob, you have an answer to the question that you were asked. I hope it is not trust Google, but I will give you the floor a bit later when we have gone through the entire recommendation. And let me now invite Morgan Schmidt from the from UNESCO to comment on the part on diversity. The reason why we have asked him to do that, and he has been very kind to agree, is that in writing the recommendation, we were inspired in part by the 2005 UNESCO Convention on the Protection and Promotion of the Diversity of Cultural Expressions, and the 2003 UNESCO recommendation concerning the promotion and use of multilingualism and universal access to cyberspace. So he's particularly well placed to comment on the diversity part of the recommendation.
Thank you very much, Carol. It is indeed always a pleasure to see that the point of views, the policies, the strategies that your own organization has been promoting are being taken up and rephrased as intelligently as it is actually happening here in this recommendation from the Council of Europe. I'd like to, not just on the part of the diversity, but all in all, congratulate the Council with this recommendation, which I think is of very high quality and which certainly avoids many of the pitfalls that exist in all these areas that are actually taken up here. It doesn't mean that I wouldn't, in a more ideal world, want to maybe have a few changes here and there, but not in the chapter on diversity. In that chapter, I think the whole concept is a very, very credible and a very valuable one. I also think that the focus on both cultural and linguistic diversity is a very pertinent one. As Carl said, UNESCO has worked a lot on this with recommendations, with conventions. We also based diversity at one of the four guiding principles for UNESCO's concept of knowledge societies that we've been promoting all the way through the WSIS process and still do, together with freedom of expression, universal access, and also quality education for all. So it is indeed a very, very important issue. What I also like about the recommendation here is that it does not look upon cultural and linguistic diversity as a matter of blocking, as a matter of putting obstacles to the free flow of information. It's much more a way to encourage and stimulate capacity building and empowerment in order to ensure that the diversity actually exists also on the internet. If we look a little bit more concretely into the recommendation text, and I'm not going to read from it, then just mention four, maybe five issues that I find of great importance. One is that it takes up the issue of providing voice for the individual and for local communities. This is not just directed, but also directed, of course, to the cultural industries and to the mass media, to the very established part of the internet. But this is also directed towards the individual or the communities. And there is also a very good encouragements of governments to ensure that people get the right tools to develop their own content and to develop their own content in their own languages. I also think it's very important that the recommendation underlines the special responsibility, and here I'm going to say it, of public service broadcasters, because public service broadcasters, at least in Europe, but also beyond Europe, in other countries, do have very, very extensive web or internet operations, and they do have, via their public service remit, a very specific responsibility to ensure that the internet is having material available for the individual citizen in areas that may not be as sexy or as profitable as the ones that the commercial mass media would be pushing. So this has to do with educational, cultural, scientific, or more scholarly or academic information that the public service broadcasters do have, I think, a responsibility to ensure a place on the net. Then another issue which is very dear to UNESCO's heart, and that's the issue of preservation of digital heritage, which also has a prominent place here, and not just preservation for the sake of preservation. That in itself is very good, like a museum is very good, but also preservation for the sake of the possibility for people to have access to this heritage later on and to use it again and again and again. Finally, I think that the recommendation should also be commended for its direct encouragement of member states, of the council, and maybe beyond that at a certain point, to stimulate that users or consumers of the internet also swift to the other side and become producers of content. So all in all, I think it's a very commendable chapter, the one you have on diversity here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And finally, we come to security. This is, of course, an important issue in the use of the internet. And I would like to ask Yves Poulet to tell us what the recommendation has to say on the subject.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, for recognizing the importance of this last chapter. Perhaps you have to take the paper before you, because I will comment this paper. I will restrict myself to three major points. The first point is definitely that, according to the text of the recommendation, security means a lot of things. The second point is perhaps more important, due to the fact that internet has a global character, the Council of Europe estimates that the security problems might be correctly addressed only in the context of an international cooperation. And the third point is definitely that the effectiveness of the secure internet and of the transnational cooperation might be achieved only if two conditions are met, are present. I will come back on that point. But now, I would like to come to my first point. Security means a lot of things. If you have a look at this fifth chapter, you will discover that security means a lot of things. It means, firstly, definitely the fight against a certain number of computer offenses listed within the convention on cybercrime. That's the first thing to what the recommendation is referring. But it means also, if you turn to the last page, it means also the fact that you have to address the problem of privacy threats. And it is quite original, the fact also that you have to address the problem of consumer protection threats. And finally, it means the protection against illegal and harmful content, especially as regards the protection of children. So security is a very large concept, and definitely it is it must be considered as a condition for creating what we might call trust and confidence of people as regards their use of the internet. The second point is, in my opinion, quite interesting, because it's the first time I see that in international text. Due to the fact that the internet has a global character, the Council of Europe recommendation estimates that we might address correctly the security problems of the internet only if there is a transnational cooperation. If you have a look at the text, member states, this is the first sentence of the last chapter, member states should engage in international legal cooperation as a means of developing and strengthening security on the internet. That's quite interesting because it means that the duty of the state is not only to provide internally secure internet, but also in order to protect its own citizens to develop an international legal cooperation. I come to the last point, the effectiveness of a secure internet and of the cooperation might be achieved only if two conditions are met. The first condition definitely refers to the existence of common international convention, which must be respected and ratified if possible. And the second point is definitely the fact that the effectiveness means also the effectiveness requests also an active intervention of self-regulatory and co-regulatory mechanism. I will develop these two conditions. The first one is definitely the fact that common convention are to be respected or even ratified and effectively implemented, not only in all the member states, but also in third country. And the text makes reference to three conventions. The first one is definitely the Convention on Cybercrime, 2001. The second one is Data Protection Convention, last page, protecting personal data, means the fact that you have to ratify the article, the Convention 108, and the last point is the Council of Europe Convention on the Protection of Children. I have just a remark about what is said as regard the level of security existing in third country. As regard the Convention on Cybercrime, the text requests quite explicitly to the member state to promote the signature and ratification of the Convention on Cybercrime. That's the first chapter. As regards data protection, the text is vague, it's more vague. And it says only that the member state has just to control the level of adequacy of the protection, of the privacy protection afforded in third country. My personal opinion, I speak before my colleagues and my friends of the Council of Europe, my personal opinion is that the Council of Europe had to develop the same efforts to promote the Council of Europe Convention on Data Protection that the Council of Europe Convention on Cybercrime in order to achieve a global consensus both on privacy and security. This duty is, in my opinion, justified by the fact that under Article 8, privacy has definitely the priority vis-a-vis security concerns. Okay, as regards no copyrights, it is quite clear that there are a certain number of international conventions, and the text is not referring to the TRIPS agreement, WTO, or the Bern Convention and all the WIPO convention, but definitely they are behind the text. As regards the consumer protection, it is quite interesting, and I think this is the first time that I see a reference to the problem of consumer protection in official texts of the Council of Europe. It is quite clear that consumer protection threats might be also important as regard the use of the internet and therefore as regard the security of the internet. A second condition as regard the effectiveness of promoting a secure internet is definitively the fact that the public regulation has also to promote self-regulatory or co-regulatory measures, and that this self-regulatory and co-regulatory measure must be supported by the states. If you have a look at the text, you will see that the second condition is present in all the part of the text. As regard the computer crime, you will see that the recommendation claims for empowering stakeholders to protect network and information security device. As regard the problem, of the safer internet, they make explicitly reference. If you have the text, they make explicitly reference to the encouragement of self-regulation, including the elaboration of code of conducts and the development of adequate technical standards and systems. And as regards the problem of the fight against spam, that's also a clear promotion of industry-driven initiative. So what must we say about this promotion of self-regulation and co-regulation? I think there are two principles. The first principle is definitely that self-regulation and co-regulation in the context of this directive might operate only in the limits imposed by the public regulation. It is quite clear that the first reference remains the public regulation, the law. In that context, in the limits imposed by the law, it is quite clear that self-regulation and co-regulation are not only accepted, but also promoted. Self-regulation, that's the second principle, self-regulation and co-regulation might constitute definitively an added value as regard the enforcement of the public regulation. That's the two main principles as regard the problem of the co-regulation and self-regulation. Okay, that's all what I have to say, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I was going to cut you off in a second, so good timing. Ladies and gentlemen, one theme of this IGF conference, which has been missing from our account, has been critical internet resources, but they are not overlooked in the recommendation. In the part of on access, the recommendation says that member states should develop, in cooperation with the private sector and civil society, strategies which promote sustainable economic growth via competitive market structures in order to stimulate investment, particularly from local capital, into critical internet resources and ICTs, especially in areas with low communication and information infrastructure. And I think it is important in this part which I have just read that there is a mention of cooperation between governments, private sector, and civil society. Because you may ask yourself, how does the Council of Europe propose that all of this should be implemented? Well, the recommendation replies to that by saying that, of course, the Council of Europe is an intergovernmental organization. However, it makes it very clear that in addition to what member states, governments should do themselves, they should also elaborate and delineate the boundaries of the roles and responsibilities of all key stakeholders within a clear legal framework, that they should encourage the private sector to acknowledge and familiarize itself with its evolving ethical roles and responsibilities, and to cooperate in reviewing and, where necessary, adjusting its key actions and decisions which may impact on individual rights and freedoms, that member states should encourage the private sector to develop, where appropriate and in cooperation with other stakeholders, new forms of open and transparent self and co-regulation, and that member states should encourage the private sector to contribute to achieving the goals set out in this recommendation and developing public policies to supplement the operation of market forces where these are insufficient. So in other words, public policy and public investment should come in only where market forces, where there is market failure. Otherwise, the implementation of all of this relies to a very large extent on cooperation between governments and the private sector and on the private sector itself. And it is in this context that I would like to return to you, Bob, and ask you whether you believe, as a major private sector company, that you find something in this recommendation that applies to you, that you think is important from your point of view, that you would be willing to sign up to or to implement. And as you reply to my question, perhaps you would also like to reply to Andrew's question before that. Thank you.
Of course, I'd be happy to. Well, I don't know about happy. Thank you for having me on the panel. I actually wanted to go off text and by doing so to prove that we do in fact agree with many of the goals in this text and to tell you about some of the things that the company does that achieves these goals already. And in doing so to bring our conversation into a more practical frame so that we can have a discussion about what further we might be doing. So let me address these topics one by one and tell you about some of the projects we have going and also answer the questions that have been asked. To begin with, let me address democracy. We have launched a major program at Google in order to do better voter education in the United States and to increase voter participation. In particular, we have something we call the Election Information Program. It is the first attempt, started by a private company, I might say, the first attempt in the country to ever put in one place all of the voter rolls. That is, it's a place where you can go, type in your address and your zip code, and find out where you should vote, who you will be voting for, on what ballot initiatives, and exactly if you, and also information on where your precinct is, that is where you should go in order to cast your ballot. Now that in the United States is revolutionary, because currently that information is held by states in some cases and by localities in other cases. So we see this as a cooperative project, and we've joined with 8 secretaries of state. Those are the people within states in our country who are in charge of voting processes, and also with the foundation, the Pew Foundation, which you all are probably familiar with from its many reports on the internet, in order to turn this into an ongoing C3 project, which is a nonprofit project, so that over time all of the states will be able to participate in this. And so voters all over the country will be able to go to a single site and know where they're supposed to go to vote. And that, we think, is a pretty major accomplishment, even in the course of 8 states that we're doing in the 2008 election cycle. Another thing that we've done on the election front is we've increased citizen participation, primarily through YouTube. I don't know how many people in the audience are aware, but this was the year of the first YouTube debates. There was one debate already held, and there will be another debate held by the Republicans. The first was held by the Democrats. And all of the questions came from YouTube videos. It was presented by CNN, and it was unusual, to say the least. Usually in the United States, the way that debates between candidates are held is for journalists to ask the questions. And we decided that we wanted to break the mold and instead have citizens, God forbid, ask the questions. So we arranged those debates. And we hope to carry that on in the general election as well. Another thing that I can point to is our mapping products. Many of you have probably used Google Earth and Google Maps. Those products are now being used by different groups, NGOs, different groups that care about issues, in order to help lobby on issues. They can divide neighborhoods, identify people, tell those people where to go in order to knock on doors, in order to get signatures for ballot initiatives. So we are developing tools every day that we think enhance democracy and participation by citizens. We also have a wonderful new feature, which I call Answer Back. It's part of Google News. And we developed it a few months ago and thought that it would go nowhere, but in fact it's taken off. It allows people, political candidates, average citizens, whoever, to answer back to news stories that they feel have treated them unfairly, misquoted them, or otherwise taken them out of context. And it's absolutely fascinating to see democracy at work in this way. There has really never before been, as far as we can tell, an immediate feedback mechanism for people to use. Surely you can write letters to the editors and things like this, but this has a much better impact as far as we can tell. Very popular already. On access, I would say that our company has a bias, to say the least, in favor of open source. If you look at almost every product that Google uses and produces, it is an open source product. And I will give you one example of that. Recently, 2 weeks ago, we launched our Android product along with 30 other companies in the US and abroad. That product is the first attempt to have an open mobile platform in the United States. Currently in the United States, all of the mobile platforms are proprietary. That is, the company that you sign up with has control over the device that you use. If you break the contract with that company, you pay a fine in order to move on to another company. So we wanted access to be greater for people and to offer people new ways to get cheaper and better devices. And so we've launched this project called Android. And I don't hesitate to say that I don't think that AT&T and Verizon and the other major telecommunication carriers in the United States aren't happy with what we're doing, because again, it's providing access and openness. Turning to the question of openness itself, and the question about freedom of expression and freedom of information and access. Well, this is one that I've spoken a great deal about. I'm happy to continue the discussion. And I think I ought to start in this case, however, with a bigger picture, because it turns out that people are fascinated by a few cases in which we have been asked or forced to curtail freedom of expression. But I would like to point out that in the vast, vast majority of cases, we provide information that people have never seen before and would not have access to were we not to exist, or other search engines, I should say. Let me point out first that our services are free. Users do not pay for them. And if you're talking about what's ultimately open in society, and what's the best way that you can help people access information and express themselves while not charging them to communicate is a pretty good way to start. A second thing that I would note is that people are free not to use our service if they don't like it. And that may sound kind of anti-business, anti the companies, against the company's best interest. But it's the truth, and it's really what makes our business and the search business different from others. As I've said before, our goal is to maximize free expression wherever possible. And in every case where we run into a situation where we are either forced or asked not to do that, we negotiate it as carefully as we can to the point where we feel that we've done as well as we can, and to the point where we believe that we are providing more information and therefore doing more good than we would if we were shut down in that particular country. And there are a number of cases where we have been shut down and reached compromise over time in order to get our services back up so that people could see the vast, vast majority of our products. Now, there is a disagreement among human rights groups and ourselves over whether or not this is the wisest course. As someone who has worked in the developing world, as someone who has been in government, in NGOs, and now in the private sector, having advised George Soros, a number of CEOs, it is my opinion that even if you don't provide everything, providing as much information as possible eventually will leak into people's minds and help them and empower them. I don't see exactly how the idea that you should turn off the spigot makes sense to me. It just doesn't work in my mind from my experience. And again, that's just one person's experience.
On openness, a couple of examples of things that we have been doing. On accessibility of records and documents to citizens, which is specifically mentioned in this document, we have made deals with states and federal agencies in the United States to become their search engine. We don't charge them anything for doing that. But what we have discovered along the way is that while states have search engines, they're really bad. And so if someone goes looking for information in a particular state about environmental protection or about how to get a driver's license, it's really difficult to find. And so we go in and we become that state search engine and open up a great deal of information that people have never seen before. We've done that in states, we've done that for the National Institutes of Health in the United States and for a variety of federal agencies. So we're working in that case to open up the internet. I would also say, very briefly, that we are in the forefront of the campaign for the open internet in the United States, for net neutrality, for all the different pieces of federal legislation, which we believe will allow for greater access for all people and will not allow certain companies to create a two-tier internet in which the rich people pay and they get through and the people who are startups or who don't have money can't get through on the internet. And that is a major argument that we're having in our country, and I know that in Europe people are arguing about it as well. As for diversity, a couple of examples. Our Rosetta project, which is our machine translation project, aims to have 40 languages in about 6 to 8 years, I believe the date is. I think that in and of itself, the process of being able to have interpretation and translation, of those documents to those languages is a major, major step forward for civilization, frankly, and for people's attempts to communicate with each other, for a scientist to be able to read a paper that was written in another language and to actually put it to use, I think is a really exciting development. Our book search project is also in this area, I think will help diversity a great deal. It's a controversial project because we have been sued by publishers and others for violating copyrights. But we feel by putting many millions of books online, we give people a chance to see things that they never would have seen before. Finally, on security, let me just briefly mention one thing that's not mentioned directly in the document but is alluded to, and that is spyware. There is reference here to spam, but I would actually probably add spyware to this document if I was if I was editing it. We give a lot of money to an organization called StopBadware.org, which I encourage you all to visit, which will take complaints from the public about certain URLs, and you put the, and it shows you on Google. Google warns you. The easiest way to explain it is Google warns you not to go to this site. If this site has spyware on it, Google will say, don't go to this site unless you want your computer infected. And these are the kinds of things that I think that companies can be doing in order to work together with governments and with civil society.
Thank you very much. I think it's time to open this up to the audience and invite your questions and comments. I don't know if there's a roving mic somewhere. There should be.
This one is working, yes, indeed. My name is Thomas Lowenhaupt. I'm here on behalf of Connecting New York City, Connecting.nyc. We're a New York not-for-profit that's seeking a top-level domain for New York City. .Berlin, .Paris are here also. And I think one of the critical information resources that's missing to implement many of these wonderful recommendations you have in this document are domain names. You know, it's impossible to get a good .com name in a place like New York City now. If our immigrant population, our younger people as they grow up, they cannot start new businesses. They cannot have ideas on civic issues that would like to use the prevailing .com domain because those names don't exist. So city TLDs is a very vital issue for our global cities. And tomorrow, actually, I'm on a panel entitled Broadening the Domain Name Space, TLDs for Cities, Cultures, and Continents. And just to, you know, the names are vital, but also one of the things that the search engine transparency is I think, a vital issue also. And one of those is that if you look at election time, how that's handled, and you know, one of the things that we're trying to figure out with the .nyc TLD is how you determine you know, the answers that come up when you do a search on an issue or an election, and perhaps Google can say how we might be able to develop a feeling of trust on a search engine that will allow civic issues to be handled in an appropriate way. But I just think this is a delightful document. And I wrote a paper along with Dr. Michael Gerstein last April entitled Towards City TLDs in the Public Interest. It was a white paper, and but this stuff will just fit in there nicely. We'll be revising it with all your many excellent suggestions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Can we quote you? I'm delightful and excellent. Thank you. Any further questions or comments, please? Yes.
Hi, good afternoon. So my name is Eva Trisson from Paris University. I've got a very simple question. This is regarding this wonderful principle of recognizing the public service value for the internet. What does it imply in terms of liability and cost? Does it mean the states and the private companies recognizing this principle will be held liable for not providing an affordable, safe, accessible access? And in terms of cost for the infrastructure, Who will cover the cost for building the infrastructure, the technology for providing this affordable access? You said we need to have a market failure to get cooperation between states and industry. But I mean, for wireless, for example, can a user sue a state or a private company for not having provided, for example, a wireless network in a city? Or just liability and cost.
Thank you very much. I think I'll call in my lawyer on this and ask Andrew to deal with this.
Je pense que ceci est une très bonne question, effectivement, une question clé pour nous. I think that's an absolutely central question that you've raised. And for me, it requires us to kind of gaze into the crystal ball a little bit and try and think what will happen in terms of people being able to hold others liable under standards of this sort. And what I think will happen, and this is just my opinion, but it's one that I shared with Bob's colleague, Joanna Shelton from Google earlier this afternoon, is that I think people are increasingly going to seek to hold someone accountable for the fact that their rights and freedoms are not being respected in the online world. And what I think gazing into the crystal ball is going to happen is with the assistance of lawyers and people with inquiring minds like yourself, they are going to seek to find ways to have a hook to the state, because that's the classic way in which citizens have been able to hold someone to account for not respecting their rights and freedoms. And when that happens, and I think it is beginning to happen, there are challenges heading to the Strasbourg court and so on, I think what is quite likely to happen at that stage is that the state is going to turn back to those provider companies and seek to find ways in which it can either escape its liability or preventively tighten the controls that it has on those companies in the future. So I'm very glad you brought that up, because for me it highlights something which I think is a key feature in these multi-stakeholder conversations, which is, and I just want to put this back to Bob again, sorry Bob, that sometimes what you say is not the same thing as other stakeholders hear. And I had three quick examples, if you allow me, Carol. For example, when you say, well, you know, freedom of expression, okay, but our services are free, what I tend to hear is that Google aren't charging to restrict freedom of expression. When you say that people are free to not use our services, I tend to hear, well, if customers don't like it, then they're free to go away. And when you say that we're providing as much information as possible, and that's better than nothing, yes, it almost certainly is better than nothing, but will that be an adequate defense to possible future claims on the part of people who genuinely feel, and are correct to feel by reference to international human rights standards, that their right to privacy or the right to freedom of expression hasn't been fully respected? So my suggestion might be that, again, looking ahead, that certain corporations, including Google, might be well advised to look at the issue of human rights proofing their internal processes and procedures, especially those that involve making decisions about potentially restricting rights, in order to close off in a more proactive way the possibility of, at a certain point down the line, even at arm's length and through the intermediary of states, being held accountable for the fact that people using their services aren't able to enjoy their rights. Donc, merci beaucoup pour la question, madame.
Yes, I'm not a lawyer, but I think this is a recommendation, not a binding text, so therefore there is no legal responsibility for states. But there is, of course, political responsibility, and that, I think, will count for more and more. I'll give you a chance to respond, Bob, we don't have a lot of time.
Right, when I was talking about the services being free and people being free to go elsewhere, I was trying to put it in context rather than line it up against free expression, if you know what I mean. I was trying to say, here's the entire system. Let me, though, say that the future is here if you're talking about these kinds of suits. another company is currently being sued in the United States for something that it did in a separate foreign country. The claim is that they violated someone's rights by showing the IP address. And it's quite a case, and it's quite a it will be a landmark case, is my guess. I doubt that it will, I don't know whether it will set a precedent or not, but it's an important case for people to watch who are concerned about who is going to be legally liable for what. We know at Google that you can be sued for anything on any day.
Andrew, 5 seconds, then Matthias.
Yeah,
I will give you the floor.
Just very quickly, and for purposes of clarification, of course, this particular recommendation isn't legally binding. But I think, as I said at the outset of my remarks, that one of the most important things in it is it reaffirms a standard that is at least 31 years old as regards the right to freedom of expression, and that is legally binding jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights reaffirmed in this recommendation.
Thank you, Matthias.
Yes, very, very briefly. I'm very grateful to the contribution of the gentleman mentioning the question of search engines and also the question of domain names. I can tell you, actually, you are right. It is not mentioned here, and it's one of the topics, especially the search engine transparency topics, that we have very principally started to discuss if this could be one of the topics within the work plan of maybe either already next year, or then we have a big ministerial conference in 2009, and we are working now on new action lines. And so this is exactly what we need also from, let's say, all stakeholders to have an input where you say there might be further topics for us to work on. And I think we will be very happy both to come back to these two topics that you have proposed, and me actually as chairperson of the committee, we'll be happy also to forward your contribution at the next meeting. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Schneider already has a microphone, so he is his first. But then, of course, the gentleman over there.
Ha. Okay, it works. My name is Thomas Schneider. I work for the Swiss regulator Ofcom. First of all, I would like to thank the authors for this document, which is, I think, is an excellent document. And it's excellent because it doesn't start with the internet as something new, but it takes the fundamental freedoms and rights of everyday life and asks the question, how can internet enhance these rights, and what should be done to avoid that the internet maybe restricts these rights and freedoms? And I think this is a very good start, and I hope this document gets spread. I also like the notion of public service, which comes from the traditional media, and I hope that this helps to take over this value to this new media, to the internet, because I think this is a very useful value. And being a European, I hope that this notion also makes its way throughout the world, because it's until now rather a European phenomenon that we have this service value. And one thing that also struck me was the question of cost. Who's paying for these things? And linked to that, the question on outsourcing state or former or supposed state responsibilities to private sector companies. And that leads me to the representative of Google. I think there are very beautiful and lovely things that we heard. I was just going asking myself, when you say our services are free, you don't have to pay it, you can use it, somebody has got to pay, because somebody has got to pay your salary, and somebody has got to pay for the money that you spent on YouTube and other things. So somewhere, somebody has got to pay. And I think this is something that I would like to ask you to maybe explain a little bit more to people like me who don't know your philosophy that much. How I don't think that you're an altruistic company, but you want to make money. What is your philosophy on how you want to make money, and not only the providing side, but also the where do you does your money come from side? And for instance, one experience that I made, I do not use Gmail, for instance, but I once looked over the shoulders of a friend who used No, I don't. Who used Gmail, and then I realized that while writing an email, he just had the offers according to what is in his mail, kind of what words you type, you get the offers from other companies, where to find information or where to buy products. And probably this is a part of where the money comes from to finance those things. And I do not use, I'm one of those who does not use those services because I rather have my privacy and does not want any company to know exactly what is in my mails and then to provide me with products. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before you answer, Bob, I would encourage Google to declare independence. If you declare independence, we'll admit you to the Council of Europe as a member state, and you can teach us how to make money on promoting human rights.
Let me very briefly say that our revenue comes from advertising of two sorts, what we call AdWords, when people buy words and then are seen on the right-hand column under something called sponsored links. It's a constant auction for who appears first in that column, and I can explain it at other at greater length. The other program is called AdSense, when a website uses our ads on its website, when it hosts our ads, we power the ads there. So if somebody goes onto that website and they're searching for a certain thing on that website, the ads on the right side are powered by us. If someone clicks on an ad, the website owner gets about 75% thereabouts of the revenue, and Google gets the rest of the revenue. So that's the general model, and let me say it's much more complicated than that. We also sell certain enhanced versions of our software, but it doesn't add up to anything compared to the other parts of our business. Now I'm blanking on the important question here that you wanted me to answer.
Question of privacy.
Oh, privacy. Little known. You can opt out of all of this on Google. If you don't want your information shared, on the second page, when you go to the second page of Google, you'll see the privacy page. And you read our privacy policy, and you'll see that if you do not want your information recorded, your searches recorded, anything like that, there is an opt-out provision. And I urge everybody to go look for it because it's there. And so our philosophy is basically if people don't want their information shared, well, then they shouldn't have their information shared.
Thank you very much. Can we now ask you to end you afterwards?
Thank you. My name is Frederick Dunk. Thank you for commenting this very interesting document. I mean, I just discovered it when you were speaking. And yes, it gives many angles, so thank you for this. I got one question along those lines, and I will frame this again along those lines. Sorry if I missed something. But my question actually makes an echo to Mr. Poulet's intervention also on the security issues. To me, I see near security, a natural driver for security would be trust. And while you were speaking, I've been to the old good Oxford English Dictionary, and the definition of trust is confidence in or reliance on some quality or attribute of a person or thing, or the trust of the truth of a statement. It might very well apply to internet as well, and I would like to see your comment on whether we might see something even a more greater emphasis on trust with security, for example. Thank you.
I mean, if I got you right, the question is how can we link trust and security as such? Yeah, that's exactly one of the issues, brand actual, that we are discussing within the Council of Europe. We actually have considerations how to bring in the topic of trust, which is discussed within the information society debate, mostly as technical term, trust in infrastructure. How do we get it in the trust of in content and sources? The problem about this topic that we face, the more we discuss it, the more we face the problem. We maybe start in a debate that we just had in this workshop on quality of the internet, because what is trustful information? Of course, we speak of islands of trust in the internet, for example, provided by public service media and so on. That's fine. But is this really a state issue or a debate that should be led by the intergovernmental, debate, to debate on trusted content, because this might also be dangerous, finally, come out that state authorities restart defining what is trust for content. Nonetheless, I'm quite optimistic that we will find a solution how to cope with the problem. Maybe trust in internet and with a big question mark. But as a debate, as a policy debate, we will go on this. And I will hand over to.
Yeah, definitely, security is a very large concept. It includes availability of the information. It includes definitely the confidentiality of the information, and also the integrity of the information. And on all these aspects, you might imagine a certain number of methods in order to achieve the three points. And the problem is to know exactly the demand of the public on all these three points. It is quite clear that for the moment, if I have a look at the problem of privacy, there is not a lot of demand from the public. It is a concern for public authority, perhaps for privacy-minded people like myself, but it is quite clear that there is really a problem as we ask this question. As we have the problem of integrity, I am not sure. You know that the failure as regards the development of electronic signature, it is quite clear that the famous secure electronic signature developed as a model by the German authorities is definitely a failure in the European Union. So I'm not sure that there is a so big demand for security, except perhaps as regards the problem of spam, because it creates really a very big concern for everybody of us. As regards the question of computer crime, I think it is quite clear that we become very concerned by the problem of spyware more and more. We receive a certain number of spyware, and I totally agree with the Google representative. It would be quite important to address this question. I am not sure that it is a hacking. I think we might consider that it is a hacking.
Thanks a lot, Yves. Can we ask the Russian lady from the Russian Federation to?
Yes. Dear colleagues, let me bring a bit more global perspective here. One of the main achievements of the internet and in terms of public value was these databases which keep together all the academic information like JSTOR, like EBSCOnet. However, so now you can just, if you work hard enough in 2 hours, get to know what the science in the world achieved in the problem you're trying to solve. So, but now we have a great problem of inequality of access to these databases because they're quite expensive. We have people, students or scholars in prosperous countries being able to have access to this information, but people in developed countries, students in developed countries cannot have this information. People in developing countries cannot have the information. Poor people in developed countries cannot have information. And this means that for the developing world, most students do not have chances to write really good thesis papers. Many scholars do not have chances to be sort of updated in terms of academic information. And this also means poor governance, because to be a good governor, you need to be educated, informed. I teach public scholars in Russia, and also I travel a lot in African countries. What I can hear from public servants, they really judge from wrong information, so their actions are based on common ideas, not on the research. So I think it is the task of UNESCO to do something on this problem. I know that Google has Google Scholar, but so far it's not compatible to this JSTOR and other bases. So my question is, are there plans to make sort of open databases on scholar information or something like this.
Thank you very much. Before we get an answer, I'd like to give this gentleman over there the opportunity to ask the question. And that will be the final question today.
Thank you very much. I came in late to the debate. My name is Michael Carlin, caring for our future project involved in the Millennium Process. But from the little bit that I did hear, I wanted to ask a question. As you probably know, the United Nations had the 7th Global Forum on Reinventing Government in Vienna in June, and the theme was building trust in government. And among the many, many, many themes that were discussed and so on is the efficacy of taxation and obtaining public goods, services, and social responsibility. If we look at the whole lot in a perspective, in broad perspective, the way in which taxation is used today doesn't leave a margin for private business to take on too much in terms of social responsibility. Governments have to be involved. Therefore, my question is there a case to debate a reallocation of the way in which taxation is applied so that the internet and its trustworthiness, what is public domain, what obeys government rules, what doesn't obey government rules, what is socially responsible, what isn't, those values are retained, because society alone can't can decide what it wants to see and hear, but it can't make the rules. That has to go through government. Therefore, the issue is, do we have a case to debate the use of a reallocation of the way in which taxation is used in order to guarantee there's trust and integrity on the internet? In 25, 30 years, perhaps that or more percent of the economy will be dependent on the internet. So there's a lot of issues around it, but just as a broad round. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Anybody willing to take these issues?
Well, I can at least take the one on the access to scientific information, which certainly is something that UNESCO is working at, and I'll be happy to afterwards give you more concrete information on that also, because I know we are short of time now. But UNESCO is facilitating the e-science activity line within the whole WSIS follow-up process, and creating free access to scientific information is one of the key objectives for us in that regard. In that regard, and we are building repositories and networks that are supposed to make scientific information available to all of those who do not can or do not want to pay for it, particularly scientific information stemming from public research or training institutions should, of course, be made also publicly accessible to students, teachers, whoever, who may want to know something of that. So, but I can tell you a bit more about it afterwards.
Thank you very much. The question of taxation, any takers? I'm sorry. We have to close now. It's 6 o'clock. The next session will be here in half an hour. So we have to give the people. You have an answer? taxation.
Thank you. If you allow me, just a quick answer. There are models for. There is not only taxation where money can be can come in. There are also fees. And for instance, Switzerland, many other countries, we have a system for. That we take fees from everybody who has a television, and that those fees goes to the public service broadcasters, but not only. Now we started to give money also to private broadcasters who do public service aspects, and there's a key on how to distribute this money. And we are now starting to discuss whether we have to find some means to give also part of this money to internet content providers or whatever that do something which has a public value. And you can, of course, also always start to discuss on giving public money to infrastructure providers and so on. So there are ways of doing this. And just another answer with regard to the question of trust, I think one main point is transparency, and I think the Council of Europe has discovered that and is doing a lot on transparency of private sector actors and state actors and civil society actors. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, all of you. I want to thank the panelists. I want to thank particularly the participants, the audience, for what turned out to be a very lively and interesting debate. Thank you very much.
Mr. Cech, before we close, can I just say just one word? Just to wrap up that by saying that, as far as I'm aware, this first document on the public service value of the internet is, it's the first time I've seen a document which brings about 47 states agreeing upon the importance of the right to benefit from the information society and linking the benefits of the information society to human rights, to the multi-stakeholder process, to civil society, etc. And it's very new, so we have to implement this. Member states, civil society, private sector have to go ahead and now start implementing it. So where do we go from here is the next question. It's serving a benefit in New York and in your organization, and I hope it will serve others. I just wonder what next steps civil society, private sector, like Google, if any, will take of this text and of member states in the future. And I wonder how this can go forward in the IGF, in fact, that's my question. I'd like to say thank you. On behalf of the Council of Europe, I'd like to say thank you to all of the gentlemen at this table. This is probably the last day, and many of them will be travelling back tomorrow. Thank you very much for all taking part. You've been excellent speakers, participants, confirmed participants, panellists, etc. And thank you all for coming today. Thank you.
Thanks, Lee.